Welcome to Ad Chatter, the podcast from AdPulp.com, where we gather around the virtual water cooler and talk about ads and the ad business.
Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to Ad Chatter from AdPulp.com. I'm your host, Dan Goldgeier. In a world where there's a world of information at our fingertips, what makes for quality advertising research? How does research work with strategy and creative to put a brand on a path to success? And how can researchers make authentic connections with consumers during a pandemic? Today's guest is going to enlighten us all on those topics and a lot more. Megan Averill has been a strategist and account planner at agencies across America and now heads up the Insight Inn, providing strategic consulting and consumer research. Megan, welcome to Ad Chatter.
Thank you so much, Dan. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be great because I think that coming from the creative side, research and strategy has always been important, yet it's always been a bit of a mystery. So, you know, I think you have had a lot of experience in all areas of that and you're of course a dynamic person and I've known you for a while. And you can relate to creative people as well. So we'll have a great conversation about that. But let's go back to the beginning. How did you get started in advertising and what was it about research and strategy that attracted you?
Yeah, so I had my first job dating myself way back in the early 2000s at McCann Erickson in New York. And I was an unlikely candidate for that job, given that I went to college at a giant state school in Ohio that no one knows the name of. And I just was I admire my own ambition. I actually sort of lied and told the person that I was going to potentially interview with that I was going to be in New York City, no problem. I was just going to be there this weekend. It was a total, total lie.
Yeah.
And I was looking for informational interviews, right? So she had said that she would talk to me and I drove all the way, something like 10, 11 hours straight, crashed on a friend's couch, for free, ate food from the 99 cent store and did an interview at McCann in New York. And that's how I sort of wormed my way in, because a couple months later, they were looking to replace their junior baby associate strategist on the Wendy's business. And I had sort of kept in touch with them, kind of did that whole hustle of informational interview all the way to getting a job. So I was really excited and I loved advertising, whole idea of it, to the point where I was in my ad club and was an officer in my ad club in college. That's how nerdy and geeky I was about advertising. But I found, just to sort of, end around to your last question of then how did you end up in research and strategy, as a consultancy, was that I found that after about a decade of being in advertising, I lost a little bit of the love of the process of getting from point A of here's the assignment all the way through to the creative work. And that some of that just had lost its luster, not because it's not a really interesting dynamic process, but because it had been 10 years, right? And that is just a long time to do that same thing over and over. So I made that pivot and I actually moved to Australia for a hot minute.
Oh, wow.
And I worked in research down there as the job to be okay, let me make sure I can do this full time and I really understand it. And then I opened my own thing when I came back stateside. Yeah. So yeah, it just kind of became over time, the shine of it, when I was a starry eyed kid, there was nothing better than seeing and having my parents or my friends see that ad that I helped make for Wendy's on TV.
Right.
That just sort of faded away and I became more interested in the people and the consumers behind everything. So that's kind of where I ended up.
Sure. But you go, so your first job is basically a Madison Avenue big time ad agency job. I bet, even if you're a low person on the totem pole there, that must have been an overwhelmingly cool experience because you're surrounded by not only great people, but resources. I mean, it must be a much different experience than, let's say, a smaller, somebody who's just in, the Midwest or even out here in Seattle. Was it beneficial to you to be in that environment right off the bat?
I think so. I mean, that whole baptism by fire phrase exists for a reason. Yeah. You know, everything moved. It felt like 100 times faster in New York. I mean, I spent my second job was in Chicago, and then I came west, and really no pace, not even when I went back east to Boston, really matched that account in New York. And granted, it was a huge account, right? Multi-million dollar account. It was also, and you may remember some of these days, Dan, too, it was sort of like those still, the glory days of advertising were still sort of hanging on. So in those early, you know, 2000s, it was still like drinks every night on the client and like, let's go down and walk down to the W Hotel and have some martinis and like stay out really late with our team. And like, that was a fairly frequent occurrence, and it was all on the agency, you know, the cards were coming out, the agency business cards. I mean, that was very much like the scene of advertising. And I felt like I experienced the last few years of that. Right.
Yeah. Because I never worked in New York City like that, but you know, I had micro versions of those experiences.
Yeah. Right. If you've read Ron Elgin's book out here in Seattle, then, you know, they were basically doing that at the Met downtown. Right. But like, yeah, I mean, it was slick. It really was. And I was a kid from Ohio. And so the sheer just like glamour of like having a black car pull up to my crappy apartment that I could barely afford, you know, to take me to whisk me off to the airport, you know, was just astonishing. It was really beyond my wildest dreams for myself, partly because I came from, you know, the Rust Belt where there really was nothing. Not even a glimmer in our eye that we could do something like that. So yeah, I mean, the budgets were massive. I remember we did an integration with like American Chopper, which was the reality show that was like the biggest reality show at the time. And it was just that kind of level of like, you know, the infancy of some of these things that we now do like crazy, but at that time had not a fragmented audience, but a massive, massive audience, right? So we were just not just able to do things and try things, but we were also just reaching just a massive number of people every time we did it. So it was really interesting and very dynamic personalities. I mean, some of the biggest personalities I ever knew in advertising were from that New York agency and have continued to be among, I mean, here we are almost, you know, 20 years later, and they're still chief executives of, you know, global sort of, you know, holding companies. And so they're still out there making waves. So it was nice to be in the same room with those people and start really by learning from who are still sort of the best.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally understand that. So let's fast forward a little bit to now. You know, you can, you know, you talk about this glamorous, this luster, this, you know, probably an era of bigger budgets and bigger ideas and just bigger executions. How has the strategy and and more specifically the research world that you're in changed along with that? Is there just less money, less time, less interest? What's the state of it right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I'm sure it really, to me, what I see is that it varies by client and industry and things like that. But what I find most sort of fascinating is that in the world of marketing and advertising, there are people that either buy into the idea of research and find it really valuable. And if so, those are the ones I feel like that are doing 80 to 90% of all the research work done. Mm-hmm. And then there's people who just really fundamentally don't believe in it, either believe their instinct is better or believe that, you know, consumers are lying to them or themselves or whatever. And for whatever reason, they don't tend to like it or invest in it. And sometimes, and very often, those people are in the same company, right? So you have one client who very much believes in surfacing what the consumer has to say, and the other, you know, client that might even be of you know, equal weight in the room may think it's bollocks, right? So it's really one-to-one and individual. You know, when you're talking with people about research, they're either all in, like, yes, it's so important to hear what the customer has to say, and we should really be building things around them and their preferences and their attitudes and their beliefs. And there's just a whole audience who just kind of goes like, yeah, that's okay, but that's not for me, right? And it's sometimes in the same room at the same time, right? So it's really dependent. I don't feel like there's a lot of trends I see in one industry versus another. Like right. It really is just like, if you're a person that believes in it and you're in a B2C company, you're going to take that belief to your B2B company and still do a lot of research over there and find value in it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But from a strategy standpoint, like how has strategy like changed over the time? I mean, I feel like that is a far more interesting evolution in the sense that I've sort of seen this, that, you know, when we were, you know, in the early 2000s, you know, starting, you know, in some ways, it was rare for me to meet a strategist who'd done that their whole career.
Yeah.
It was account people who had moved over. It was people who'd come from a psych background. It was people who'd come from, you know, different disciplines. And, you know, I was really unique in that 10 years that I was in advertising, because that was the only job I ever did from the time I was a little baby all the way up to the time that I was, you know, a vice president and heading these accounts. And so that is how infancy in some ways strategic planning still was, even though it had been around and that there had been proponents of it. You know, there was still a lot of accounts when I started that didn't have it, didn't want to pay for it. Right. Yeah. I remember that being the commentary, right, of like, how do we show value in strategy to get people to pay for it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, now I think it's a totally different bear. And we also have sort of seen that shift where when social and digital strategy came in, for a long time, they were like adjacent to brand strategy. And it was like, okay, now you're a brand strategist and here's these digital and social strategists. And now I feel like it's kind of all wrapped back into one. And now you're just a strategist again, yeah. But you may come from any of those skill sets. And I feel like brand strategy in some ways is the outlier now, that it is a less, there's less people that sort of represent like, okay, this is a big brand thinking. This is broad thinking. This is brand at the highest level of brand versus, you know, somebody might be a strategist, but have only come up through a social background and therefore may not have that sort of kind of lateral and high level thinking on their shoulders coming from that particular modality.
Right. Right. I mean, has there been too much of a shift into like the SurveyMonkey world where everybody's just kind of sending out these digital sort of surveys, online-based research or whatever? Is there too much of that versus getting out into the world and talking to people?
Yeah. I mean, I you're never going to find someone who agrees with that more. I think, you know, yes, especially, you know, qualitative observational intercept research. Like I'm a real believer in just like stopping what you're doing, which is might just be to be like, I'm going to write a paragraph about how people feel. And it's like, well, or you could just sort of go out and talk to them. Right. And just like,
yeah.
You know, see people interact with a shelf or see people interact with your product or service. And usually the barrier to entry for that is very low. But certainly, yes, if you want to go that route of being like, I need to understand why someone's doing what they're doing, a survey is a pretty lousy tool to tell you that, especially one that's not written by a professional, right? One that's just sort of cobbled together by the team. Mm-hmm. I, you know, have seen a lot of those surveys. I have taken those surveys. I like to sign up for those surveys. I took a 45-minute phone survey the other day.
Wow.
Because
45 minutes, that's a lot.
45 minutes. You know, they always tell you it's going to be 15 to 20. It never is. Yeah. It was a freaking 45-minute phone survey. But they had, you know, I'm taking it because I want to hear how they're asking the questions. I want to hear how they're structuring it. And what I think is the biggest, you know, thing that I see in surveys that are just crafted by anybody is there is just a ton of leakage of your viewpoint into that survey, right? You know, mm-hmm. like, you know, just stuff I see from clients where it's like, well, you know, fill in this blank, you know, this is the best service because like, that's definitely something, but it's not necessarily the right thing to be asking. Or I'll see, you know, kind of a bunch of tangible and intangible things in the same entry blank, tangible being things like, okay, the chairs are soft, and intangible things being like, I like this brand. Very simple. Those shouldn't be in the same battery. There's absolutely no way that someone can respond to those as if they sit on the same level. So, you know, in the like laundry list of surveys that I feel like I've seen over time, I see so many tactical errors within them. And that's sad, but what it results in is bad data.
So, yeah, right.
I've also seen organizations take that data where they had intangibles and tangibles in the exact same entry blank and be like, oh, people only picked the tangibles. So therefore people only care about low prices and, you know, clean bathrooms or whatever, where the easiest mm-hmm. things to check in the box in a survey. Yeah. And they'll build their whole business around that. They'll make decisions based on that. They'll decide, you know, what feature they're going to add or highlight in their marketing based on that. And that's upsetting. That's the part where you start to be like, ooh, like one bad survey isn't the end of the world, you know, but what you're doing with that data and how that data gets socialized and becomes part of the hallway talk in an organization can actually have like a many rungs out implication beyond that one bad survey that somebody who kind of didn't know what they were doing threw out in the world.
Yeah. So when somebody hires you and you work for both brands on and directly for agencies, what's your approach to starting it? Do you say, I want to do qualitative, I want to do both? I mean, how do you get the conversation started?
Yeah. I mean, usually it's what's the most pressing thing that we need to solve for, right? Like starting with that objective is the biggest thing. And that's true for creative brief, right? And like understanding, well, what are we doing here? What is the point of this assignment, right? And when you get a vague answer for that, you know, your creative is going to be worse off in the end, right? Because it's like, well, what are we trying to do? It's sort of a badly formed assignment is going to lead to a badly formed outcome.
Right.
Same thing in research. You know, like I've had people be like, oh, like, let me approach this. Like, what would you recommend for our category? Or what would you recommend for coffee, which is our product? And it's like, no, you're thinking about it wrong. Like, what's going on in your business? You know, are you, do you have a leaky bucket? Are people, you know, just suffering from attrition? You know, you've got sort of waves of people leaving you. Or do you think maybe you don't know how many people are out there that could be attracted to your product? And maybe you actually need to quantify that a little bit. Well, then I'm not going to go like, we should do, you know, qualitative for that. That's a quantitative market sort of sizing study, right?
Right.
So you really kind of know and start with what is basically keeping you up at night. Like if I just meet someone cold and they haven't come to me for like any particular like need, you know, one of the first things I'll ask them, no matter where they sit in the business, whether on like ops side or supply chain or marketing or in HR or whatever function they serve within an organization, it's just sort of like, you know, what's bothering you right now? And that is a really great place for me to start to try to figure out what could potentially help them. I mean, 80% of our problems, it feels like, are people problems.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I see a lot of people struggling with recruitment right now. And that's interesting because they are talking about recruitment. But when I've talked to employees over the years, and I have in many different industries, I think about retention a lot as a result of doing that, because I've heard what basically keeps people, you know, stuck to and motivated within a job and what makes people, you know, leave. So ultimately, you know, I know that, you know, there's just been so much renewed focus on something like that. And yes, you can throw a lot of money and hiring bonuses at people. No problem. That might solve your application problem.
Right.
It doesn't solve your employment problem, because there's a lot of why, there's a lot of human emotion, and there's a lot of irrationality, let's face it, in how we all think about and make all of our decisions. They're often emotional, especially when it comes to our work. And so it's like kind of a missed opportunity a lot of times, I think, not to look at that other side of the coin. So, you know, when somebody articulates a challenge, that's where I'm like, okay, there's a human side of this. There's a people side of this, and we can find it and find out how to help you.
Yeah. I mean, you hit on something that's so core to this business, is that people are irrational and people are emotional, and it affects how we live our lives and our purchasing decisions and, you know, how we approach the world. So I'm not even sure if there's a question here, but I mean, how do you convince a boardroom that, you know, hey, this conclusion I've reached is not a logical one. It's an emotional one. It's what people are feeling. It's what I heard.
Yeah.
You know, people want, we're living in such a data and analytics. Everybody's like, give me the data, give me the hard facts. But, you know, sometimes you just can't quantify some of those things, or can you?
Yeah, no, sometimes. I mean, the answer is sometimes on you can quantify these things, but a lot of times the things you're talking about with emotional things or thorny things or vulnerable things, you know, those are the real reasons I think a lot of us make, you know, the behaviors we end up making. But a lot of the time, if you just ask people about why they did what they did, that first rational response is what you're going to get. So you do have to have that deft hand, especially if you're going into qualitative, to try to get beyond that and try to get down to the emotions of a thing. And it's not easy. And it's not something I see done very often in research, and that's upsetting. And it's a lot of why I went into research, was to try to bring more emotional sort of competency into especially the qualitative side of that. You know, I think there's a great example, Dan, when you were talking about, like, how do you convince people? There's plenty of times that I am telling clients that consumers believe or feel something that just isn't true, that is objectively not true, right? So I had a client and they were in the car repair business, and they had sort of, they knew from all their data, right? All their operations data, exactly what was going on. Very data-driven company about when cars were coming in and out and how long they were there and things like that. And it didn't matter. What I had to explain to them is, like, time is an illusion, right? Time is temporal bias is actually one of the biases that we all have. And of course, it takes a minute to think about it. But of course, if you're sitting in a waiting room that's all white and has, you know, zero to entertain you, and maybe you forgot your phone at home, that 5 minutes is going to feel very like different. An hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Than if you just sort of were, like, watching your favorite show on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it was about sort of like easing them into that gooier, you know, much more nebulous perception is reality part
right.
of people and, like, the mess that people are. You know, it was such a challenge, and it can be such a challenge for those data-driven organizations that are so they think they're very objective and they like the objective. It's really easy to hold on to, you know, on especially an operationally driven business, and from restaurants to retail to car repair to on and on. I've worked with so many of them. It's a clean thing to be there. And when you're telling them something that directly contradicts something they know to be true, but you're telling them it's important to know that way and almost to reframe their own thinking that way. Yeah, it can take sort of 25 years of experience in the business, and almost to them feel like you're throwing it out the window, right? Like, what do you mean? You know, like, what are you going to tell me about this? But it's just the consumer perception, you know, of things. There was a really good example for that same client, and I don't think I'm giving anything away, where, you know, they were really always excited from an operations standpoint if they could get a customer's car back to them from a repair center early. Right.
Yeah, right.
If they could be like, wow, we beat our estimate by a day. We said Friday, but it was Thursday. Aren't we cool?
Yeah.
Consumers hated that.
Oh, yeah.
For a reason that's incredibly obvious. If you stop
and can't plan,
I don't have a ride to come get there.
Right. Yeah.
I set up my ride for Friday. I had my whole week planned around that. Maybe you didn't put a lot of meetings on your calendar for Friday, so you knew you could leave at a drop of a hat to go get it. And then you get that call on Thursday, and it totally screws up your vibe. It messes up your life.
Yeah.
So they were just, like, so bent out of shape because they were like, wait a minute, like, we did good. We know we did good. And it's like, yeah, you did. But here's why that expectation and reality means so much more to them than getting it done early.
The surprise and delight is very surprising and not very delightful.
Delightful, right? Yeah, that's very much the case. And, like, the things, and I find that too, in people's journeys and customer journeys, the things that companies think are the high points and then the low points of the journey, without talking to people about that experience, be it a retail experience or a purchase experience or maybe a web experience or whatever it is, you know, oftentimes they sort of go out of balance, and the things that the company thinks are the high point, people think are the low points, and vice versa, right? So there's a lot of difficulty in those conversations too, especially when a company is giving itself a pat on the back for something they think they're doing great.
Throughout, so you've worked on all sorts of businesses, all sorts of verticals. Are there two or three themes that always come up that you always kind of instinctively know consumers are going to say, this is what's important to me, this is what's not important to me?
You know, it's a great question. I would say I see some themes sitting back with people, and it's that, you know, well, let me say, you know, they're very overtaxed while also being very lazy. And I say lazy, not in a way of judgment, as in like, we're all that way. So, like, I think one of the biggest things I see consistently is clients or companies or marketers or advertisers think that consumers are fairly versed in their business or their vertical, or like they just know a lot about maybe a product or service they use every day.
Yeah.
Right. And really not even the bare minimum is actually what is really known. People aren't sort of taking their free time and, like, investigating, internet speeds to decide which internet speed is right for them. Mm-hmm. They're just sort of going like, what's the fastest? Give me that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I never have to think about it again. You know, I think of people's heads as like this, like they just want to clean slate their heads and sort of wipe it like an etch-a-sketch. And I think for a lot of marketers or advertisers, like we have this idea that we're like planting seeds, right? We're going to fill their heads with little nuggets or little themes or, you know, a nugget of a brand strategy or brand idea or an ad that they think is cool. And then they're going to come back to us. And certainly that happens, right? Those perceptions are being built. But what people are also looking to do is to just like not think about anything for too long.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think
and to just wipe that memory bank clean. So
we are also guilty of that in this business, thinking our clients' products and services are anybody's top of mind.
Yeah.
You know, at any one point, and it's and the things that are important to our clients are not what's always important to consumers.
Yeah. I find that we're often like 50 levels deeper than they are. Right. Yeah. Like you kind of like, it would be a good rule of thumb to say like, okay, we're here now, let's back out another like 40, you know, paces because we've gone too far for comprehension for people. And it's, I think the other thing is that, especially if it is a category they think they should know more about, that's when consumers can come dangerous, right? It can be a little dangerous to be like, oh, well, I use internet every day. So I should tell you all the things I know about the internet and internet speeds now, you know, and you start to get into this conundrum where you're accidentally, especially if you're doing research or things like that, you might be pushing people into a corner. You know, it's sort of the reason that, you know, people have a you know, that perception that people don't know what they want or they don't know what they're talking about. Well, a lot of times we're pushing them farther than they sort of go on a product or service. And then we're sort of taking what they say at their word. Right. You know, there's a little bit in there of just like, I don't know, has to be good enough sometimes too. A lot of second theme, maybe it's an intertwined theme. Going back to the perception as reality thing, is just that these perceptions can be so hearsay, man. Like people are sort of like forming whole impressions about what your product or your service or your category or your brand is based on the scantest, smallest little pieces of things that they've heard from other people, or that thing they saw online for a half a second, but didn't read the article, or, you know what I mean? Like it is sort of this really loose. I think that somebody defined brand as like a loose constellation of, you know, different thoughts and perceptions. I think doing research, I realized just how loose that really is. Yeah. Like it can really be a constellation that's made up of things that your brand or product and service has never said about itself.
Right.
But instead are things that, you know, Sally, who also goes to my beauty shop, also said, or something that, you know, somebody who I don't even follow on Twitter retweeted, right? And I saw a glimpse of it and I thought about it for like a half second. And that was 10 years ago, right? Some of those perceptions, unfortunately, and I don't even know how you could ever pinpoint them all, are just out there in the universe, up there in the sky. And sometimes, you know, when they do coalesce, when they're not just totally random, and I do hear them over and over again when I do research, sometimes you just have to run at those, whether it's something that has ever been true or not, right? Yeah. It might just be that, oh, people assume, you know, that my category is, you know, crooked, right? You know, like there's a lot of people that have associations over time. If there's one product or one service that screws up in a category, mm-hmm. they can poison the well so fast.
Yeah.
And then other brands are sort of living with that forever, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. it's a really interesting thing how those perceptions might feel very old or very tired or like, oh, that was, you know, however many years ago. These things can just like needly stick. So loose constellation of perceptions, man, that I don't think anyone, you know, ever really has a beat on until we go talk to people.
Yeah. Gotcha. I want to focus on something that creative people love to focus on. And that is literally focus groups. I was a kid and my mother used to get phone calls to get on, you know, be part of a focus group. And even I did that when I was a young kid. Of course, you can't tell them now that you work in advertising because you're just eliminated. You don't get the free M&Ms.
Totally.
But, you know, a lot of creative people have this very love-hate relationship, and mostly hate relationship, with focus groups, because that's where the ideas go to die, or that's where you hear some very strange, you know, opinions that may not be valid, or they are valid or whatnot. My question to you is, what is the state of focus groups in 2022? Do they work? And if so, what's the right way to go about running them?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of territory there. I mean, it's a very loaded question, in the sense that I think I've read about the death of focus groups, as you probably have, every single year. There's one.
Everybody wants to write the death. They want to write the obituary. Yeah. They're not going to kill them off, though.
Yeah. Here's the epitaph for focus groups. You know, look, I think there is a strange bedfellows thing between strategy and creative, let alone between, you know, creative and research, right? Yeah. I mean, because here's somebody who, you know, is coming in and saying, hey, there's this other point of view we need to pay attention to, and it's important, right? And it's like, yeah, this kind of gums up the whole process if you're creative sometimes, right? I think what, you know, I've sort of found is that my strategy years sort of prepared me for a lot of those conversations with creatives as a researcher. I know a lot more about the aims of creatives and what they're really looking to do and what matters to them, having spent so many years really working right alongside with them. So going into research, you're not just like, oh, who the heck are these guys? You know, what is their agenda? It's like, you know, you've been there. So
Right. Yeah. How
do you sort of take that and that information, that knowledge, and sort of funnel that into what we're doing? You know, it's funny. I've had people observe my creative sort of like, I'll use the word testing lightly, right? Testing for creative. And sometimes I have to run them like a field general, but they're always incredibly structured.
Yeah.
So my short answer to your question is structure those suckers to the ends of the earth, and really keep it focused on what's productive for your client, your business, and your creatives to know. And frankly, and I think that's the easiest demon of all, what they like, what consumers like, is of absolutely no interest to me as a researcher. I don't care.
Really? Yeah.
I do not care, because what they like isn't really going to make them pull towards or away from a brand all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I could ferociously dislike something or a piece of creative and be like, that was absolutely appalling, but it got my attention and it made me remember that product or service, or it made me want to use that product and service because it got my attention long enough to share something about it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So personal subjectivity is really the death of focus groups that are about testing work. That's where creatives go nuts, where it's like, his shirt shouldn't be red, or I don't like that line of dialogue. So I think you just really have to carefully construct. So if you were ever, or any of your listeners were ever doing it, right up in that upfront of focus groups that are about sort of the evaluation of work, I always say we are focused on the forest, not the trees today.
Yeah.
I give that sort of analogy that everyone knows of, like, you know, you can't see the forest for the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, we are talking only at the idea level today. And if you go to the tree level, I'm going to stop you. You know, I basically make that abundantly clear.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just sort of very tightly structure the way that, yeah, you know, you might, with an unruly podcast guest, you're going to jump in with a new question. If somebody is starting to get off track, you're going to be like, hey, what about this? And let me direct the conversation over here. So I think it's a more active moderation.
Yeah.
It's a more structured group. And I think you've got to keep that structure focused on the topics you care about. So if you know, a client that I just did testing for at the end of 2021, breakthrough was incredibly important to them. So speaking of ways that whether somebody likes something or not doesn't really matter, they were really just focused on, we have a small budget and we need a ton of people to pay attention to this.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were little ways and tactics throughout the group where, like, by the end, I had never asked them what they liked. I never asked them, but we were asking, like, what would make you gravitate toward the brand? What would make you want to use this service? At the end, you know, I actually did a faint away where we did a little exercise that pulled them away from thinking about the ad concepts for a second, you know, pulled them back and said, okay, now it's time for me to basically figure out which one of these concepts are still rolling around in your brain.
Yeah.
And the one that they answered back didn't have to be, and you could tell sometimes it was ones that people had not had a lot of personal affinity for, because you could tell by their tone,
mm-hmm.
but that would maybe be the one that they mentioned at the end. So that's just one example of structuring for something that this client needs, that they want to be true of the creative work they put out in the world.
Yeah.
And we had our own little tactical ways of sort of helping them understand what was going to be the most breakthrough thing, including changing the order. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like there's a little bit of, there's a lot of psychology in getting people to give you the answers that you want,
you know,
instead of they're just being performative and telling you what they think you want to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And like, it's interesting because this kind of research that we do for marketing and advertising is so completely different than clinical research or research where you really have to be objective.
Yeah.
There is a subjectivity to all research, even the most sort of like open-ended research I do, it still has an aim. There's still a goal in mind at the end, right? Yeah. I still need to know whether this is, you know, making you more interested in this company or this brand. And so, yes, there are times that I'm really just sitting very far back in my chair and saying, tell me about yourself, but that's very rare. You know, a lot of the times we sort of need to know about people, but we need to know about people so we can write personas.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's a very different exercise. So I need to make sure that I know when I'm doing that research, here's the four or five categories of things we're going to need for that persona, or we're not going to have it by the end if I just say, tell me about yourself.
Yeah.
So there is a structuring and a research design around objectives that sort of takes us out of that space where we're just sort of like, no matter what we hear, it's fine. You know, we need to do a little bit of crafting in this particular kind or style of research.
Sure. Sure. So I don't know if focus groups are going to be, you know, in-person focus groups are going to come back as much as they were before the pandemic. But, you know, that leads me to my next question is that we're now in year three of the unprecedented times. What behavior changes have you noticed just among people, among families, you know, that brands need to be aware of? Is there anything, is this changed us all permanently?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, and I try to be not someone who's like a far prognosticator. I try not to be very definitive about like consumer attitudes, because don't get me wrong, like this could all change tomorrow. And when things open up, like people would just be like, and just sort of forget everything that happened for the last couple of years. My sense though, having spoken to people throughout, I mean, you know, the weird quirk of this job is that really starting in like week four of the pandemic is really when I started talking to people, and I've been talking to them ever since. Sometimes it's about the different products and services and categories, but at least the one thing that I think has come from this, from a company perspective, is they realize I can't just ask about my product and service anymore. I need to check in with people too and see where they're at mentally, emotionally. And trust me, that is not often the case as part of the brief of a focus group. So even if I'm taking 10 minutes just to like check in and see where people's at, I certainly have had a lot of more of those high level check-ins with people over the last 2 years and change than ever before, because usually it's like, well, we got to get straight to the point. But now it's like, if we're doing research, we would be foolhardy not to ask people how they're feeling mentally, emotionally, that kind of thing. So
sure.
I've gotten to do a lot of it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, certainly, you know, a lot of the things that the ink that has already been spilled around sort of, you know, people sort of recognizing the value of their close relationships while sort of eschewing some of the farther out relationships. I think that has continued to be the case year one, year two, year three. You know, I think people sort of focusing inward a little bit more and figuring out what does make them tick. It was sort of an existential crisis in the making. Mm-hmm. And for some people, unfortunately, that was from a mental health standpoint, very challenging. So I'm not making light. It's just more that I don't think there has ever been a time in, you know, American life where people have really had so much time to just be with themselves.
Yeah.
And that really is something that a lot of us weren't really equipped to do. And so it created a lot of interesting results. I mean, great resignation, great quit, call it what you will, you know, all of those things I think are less about, you know, I'm a dissatisfied person in my work life. And I think a lot of times it's just, I am trying very hard to find out what does satisfy me. So I think people are on a very positive journey. Mm-hmm. I think for people who were able to avoid the worst consequences and devastation of the pandemic, actually, regrettably and often say with some consciousness that they're actually quite chuffed with how things went because it brought them closer to their friends and family, because it brought them closer to understanding themselves, because it brought them closer through the, oh crap, I could die any day. Literally now it's very, very potentially close. That reevaluation and restacking of all your priorities. I mean, it just here in Seattle, and it's something that happened nationwide where Goodwill was completely overrun.
Oh yeah.
People were just sort of like, there's something behind that, right? Like behind every one of those behaviors that you guys all read about, you know, just take that pause of a minute and think, okay, what's behind that? Right. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing of just like, what is, I think they called it the Great Purge, not like the horror movie.
Right.
But, you know, there are people getting rid of a ton of their stuff. You know, what does that mean? Does it mean that, oh no, we're not materialists anymore? No, you're thinking of the wrong thing. But does it mean that people are going to evaluate what is near them and evaluate what is in their space and think much more carefully about that than ever before? Absolutely. So I think for me, when I sort of like, if I had to sum it up in a sentence, I think just that great reevaluation is really what people did. And that has a lot of different tentacles that are still going to be playing out, that are still going to be playing themselves out for years as people are trying to craft the kind of life they want to live, especially in the face of such a scary upheaval and in the face of something that was truly devastating on so many different levels. So, you know, in some ways, Dan, I would lose faith in humanity if we did just go straight back to the way that we were. And it heartens me a little bit that people with this kind of time and effort, we all binged a lot of TV and did all those things as well, but you know, they also sort of journeyed inward, and I'm kind of proud of us as a species for doing that versus just sort of being, you know, on our 12th episode of 12th season of Tiger King at this point.
Yeah. So we're recording this 2 weeks before the big game. That would be the Super Bowl. I can say it. They won't sue me. They don't know me. What's your take on it as a researcher and also as an ad person? Is it worth it for brands really at this point? Does it affect anybody's brand image long term, or is it just a big one-shot deal?
You know, when I talk to consumers, you know, and for some reason, if advertising comes up, and it's usually because we force it into the conversation, because again, people don't think about the things we like to think about, you know, people mention ads and they tend to mention them in rank order of how much money they spend throughout an entire year. So one of the common ones, and you hear this all the time, Dan, is Geico. Well,
right,
Geico
spends, sure. Oh, yeah.
700 to, you know, a billion a year, you know, McDonald's, they spend a billion a year and upward. So it's funny how like, you know, what I think is interesting to me, and certainly the Super Bowl has different objectives, right? Like if I get the most chatter and the most social conversation going, even in a 48 hour period after that, I've done more for a brand that doesn't have a lot of exposure than I could have done in years of advertising, right? Mm-hmm. But for these well-known brands and things like that, you know, it social relevance, cultural relevance, whatever you want to call it, that's very different than just like people saying like, oh, Geico ads are funny. I see them constantly, which is what they're not saying, but I know they're thinking, right? Is that I see this all the time. Therefore, it actually kind of sticks. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's quite cynical, you know, of me to just sort of like look at that and go like, well, if nobody's going, hey, do you remember that Doritos Super Bowl ad? I just have yet to see that happen in 7 years of talking to customers about marketing and advertising. Of course, for us, these things come and go, you know, as consumers, these things come and go. That said, like I said, in the Constellation example I gave, maybe your ad for the Super Bowl will become one of the stars in that constellation. Maybe that's a piece of information someone tucks away and goes, oh yeah, they cool. You know, they seem cool. They hired Lil Nas X. He's cool. I like him. I like what he stands for. So cool. Like that, you know, in 10 years, maybe if I am in need for that product or service, I'll actually use them. You know, that kind of thing. I always feel like we're just like placing these water droplets. Is it worth it? Man, I mean, I think if I, you know, after all these years of strategy and research, if I was the one who was in charge, I think I would spend my money differently. I do.
Like,
But then again, you know, like what is the importance of social relevance for your brand? You know, I get why Doritos is there every year. They have to cater toward a young audience and they have to do it well. And that requires maintaining your cool through generations. Right. you know, I saw Irish Spring pop up in this year's
advertisers.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we over at, you know, hashtag Plannerball all had a really good laugh, and I can plug Plannerball later maybe.
Yes, but please do.
We all had a good laugh because we were like, well, what is that brand doing here? But then again, if I'm sitting over there and let's say my sales have been declining since the mid 90s, maybe, I don't know if that's the case with Irish Spring, like just kind of caveating. But if that was the case, yeah, would I consider this like one last chance at some sort of relevance? Like maybe. Mm-hmm. So I think there's probably times, just like I sort of said with research, where you start with the objective and then you go from there.
Yeah.
I'm sure for some brands, I can very much see that through line, even just watching and going, okay, I can see what they're doing here. I see why they need this. And then there's other ones that it's just like, you just want to be famous.
Right.
The clients just want to be famous. You know, and, you know, we write about them. It happens, you know, famous. Yeah.
So let's say I want everybody in listening to this and beyond to hire you. I do. But let's say I didn't have the budget to hire you. What's the two or three things a brand can do is just a gut check to figure out who their customers are and what they really want?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you'd be surprised, you know, like I said, with everybody has surveys, you mentioned, you know, everybody's sending out surveys. Mm-hmm. But one thing I think that's just like the easiest thing to do. And so they'll just be like, oh, we have a customer base, let's send out a survey. But like nobody ever like calls or emails those consumers to be like, hey, here's five questions, right? Like it's a different kind of touch. You know, I remember going to a researcher conference a while ago and people being like, people don't take our surveys. Like, what's wrong with them? Why don't they want to be heard? Millennials, they like to be heard. Why don't they want to take our surveys therefore? And it's like, well, actually, you know, in the sort of new like tech world companies, I've often found that if I cancel a product or service, say a sustaining service or something like that, they'll actually do an outbound call to my phone and be like, hey, we're checking in, like, cool. You're leaving us. That's awesome. But can you talk to us about our product and service and tell us why you might've stepped away? Oh my God, how valuable is that?
An actual phone call from a human.
Yes. And it's something where I'm like, I'm quite happy to talk. Thank you very much. You know, think about all of the folks who, you know, all that knowledge lost from people who are sort of opting out of our product or service. And you and I could sit around a table and speculate as to why they're doing that.
Yeah.
But you don't really know until you ask. So that's an easy one. I often think of like customer service agents and how they're just taking inbound calls all day. And I know that to like the nth degree, clients are trying to cut cost savings and blah, blah, blah. But there's also a bunch of people who are sitting around who could place outbound calls and just be like, hi, tell me something about this product and service. So that's on a massive scale, on a super small scale. If you're a founder or you're just a small business of five or less or something like that, luckily, and I just, you know, feel this way in general, and luckily most of our products are out in the world, in the observable world, in the world we live in. You know, if you're a content creator, well, when you're sitting on the subway in New York City, you have a train car full of people who are all absorbed in content on their phones. So shame on you if you're not learning while you're on the train, be it from kind of cheesily looking over people's shoulders to just like offering people, you know, a gift card to talk to you for 5 minutes until they get off at their next stop and you promise you won't take any more of their time, right?
Yeah, that's an easy one. Yeah.
We're in a world where, especially if you're a packaged goods, this is a grocery store aisle that is open to everyone. Don't be a creeper, but certainly there's an opportunity there to observe people, to intercept people, to talk to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember when I worked on, you know, brands that, you know, would come up with maybe some arbitrary new innovation. And I think we've all been there in marketing and advertising. Like, here's this thing we made because we could.
Yeah.
And it's going to put, we're going to put the word new on it. And we're hoping that generates interest. And you're just kind of like, oof, when you're just stuck with that. A lot of times I would break that gridlock by just like clipping a piece of paper to the clipboard, going and buying $25 gift cards at Starbucks or Dunkin', and heading out into the street and just being like, what do you think of this thing? I have five questions for you. You know, mm-hmm. what do you think of when you hear the word mint? And, you know, like, you know, when you have a mint flavored thing and you kind of know there's all the cliches in the world of it's cooling, it's this, is that. Well, if you don't want to hit those cliches and you're kind of stuck, like what a great opportunity to just go even pick people's brains in a really informal way. So I'm all for that. And that's mm-hmm. highly directional and weird. And obviously you have to put your armor on because you're going to look like a weirdo and people are going to turn you down impolitely.
You ever get kicked out of the store?
Yeah, I am. And like, you know what? A lot of times, like, you're not there for that long, right? I might do two or three intercepts and be like, okay, like, I'm not going to squat here for 4 hours. But there's also times if I am working with a brand and let's say they are doing something that maybe isn't a formal research assignment, but I am employed with this marketing team. I'll just be like, hey, can you let this stores manager know that I'd love to like either stand outside or help people walk to their cars or whatever. And there's a lot of learning there. I have a consultant friend who always makes executives go and use the bathrooms in their own facilities and in their own stores or restaurants or things like that. And I think that's just all part of the same ethos of like, you can just get out there and do it. We do spend a lot of time thinking what do consumers want? And sometimes I get those requests and those are great. Those more formal requests, those deeper requests, those more emotional requests. But there's also a lot of behavioral observable requests, a lot of things that are just quick, you know, hey, can I ask you about this for a minute? So, you know, have courage. And, you know, maybe take a shot of tequila and get out there and ask people questions.
Yeah, that's great advice and also a great place to stop. Megan Averill, thank you so much for being on Ad Chatter. Tell everybody how they can hire you, which I hope they do. And tell everybody about Planner Bowl and also your Research Fallacy Friday.
Yeah, so you can find me at www.theinsightin.com, and that's INN. So that's my website. I have a contact us form on there if you're interested in just like chatting. It doesn't have to be for a formal engagement. If you just want to be like, how would I find out XYZ? I love having those conversations with people, so happy to do that. Planner Bowl is something that's coming up, as you mentioned, in a couple of weeks for Super Bowl Sunday. This is something that is started years ago as sort of just like fun between friends. All the strategists were saying, okay, all the creatives have their industry publications and everything focused on the ads, but who's focusing on that from the planner standpoint? They started a hashtag called Planner Bowl. That's spelled just exactly as you would expect, all one word. And they went out and started to just sort of chat about the ads. It caught on progressively every year. And I think last year, Dan, we were actually the third most used advertising hashtag. So okay, that was exciting. So this year, we're actually going to have a live component on Twitter Spaces. We're going to invite some special guests, some of whom are relatively, you know, big names in advertising and marketing, which is good. And just sort of have a little bit of a pregame show on Twitter Spaces. And then really the majority of it takes place just on Twitter. So we're going to tweet out in the next couple of weeks, myself and Mark Himmelsbach and Brian Wakabayashi, just tweeting out some little tips and tricks and hey, kind of here's how you participate. So pay attention if you're interested in the Super Bowl, but from a strategy point of view.
Great. And tell us about Research Fallacy Friday. I love this.
Yeah. So on LinkedIn, I kind of started waiting for everybody's research budgets to get approved, which always happens in January. I started a little series of blog posts called Research Fallacy Fridays, which I actually was, you know, hashtagging that as well, unfortunately. So I think that's a way to find it. But it is a little series of posts about sort of just misconceptions people have about research. And so, you know, just little things that I've seen over the years that kind of come into play and can actually impact the way that people think about research in the maybe gives them the wrong impression, kind of lands them in the wrong spot. So just sometimes it's about topics like recruitment. Sometimes it's about research design. Sometimes it's about whether to do research or not. All of those things are sort of, you know, topics that we cover, but yeah, just kind of having fun, kind of pointing out some of the incongruousnesses or things that I've seen that come up and I would hope to see change a little bit, even if just perceptually about research.
Sure. Sure. That's great. You know, I think research and strategy are the building blocks of great advertising and marketing efforts. So thank you again, Megan Averill, for coming on the show. And friends and colleagues, thank you for listening once again to Ad Chatter from AdPulp.com. I'm Dan Goldgeier. If you'd like to appear on the show, please let us know. If you have any thoughts or comments about this episode or any others, you can send that to us and we will talk to you again next time. Thank you all for listening.
Engineered by Dan Goldgeier in Seattle, Washington.